Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Almost everywhere you look for an image of Jesus Christ, you will find the aura-encircled, beautiful white man with light brown or blonde flowing hair, blue eyes often, and a nicely trimmed beard. But though that image and the variations on that theme are, of course, rendered by humans and bear no resemblance to how the Bible describes the man, because the Bible says very little, if anything at all, particularly. But how Jesus has been popularly depicted tells us a lot about the history of race and religion in America. According to Edward Bloom, he's a historian of race and religion in the United States and the author of several books, including his latest with co-author Paul Harvey. It's entitled The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America. It came out in August, and we welcome Edward Bloom to the show today. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You take on three myths in your book, and I wanted to sort of kick off the program with one of them, and that is that people always create God or gods in their own image. You say that's not accurate at all.
Yeah, it's, you know, like any myth, there's some level of reality, truth, and truth to it. But in this case, the notion of humans make Jesus or God in their own image, all we have to do is look around us and see how that's really not the case. We can go back and look at numerous African-American churches that have white Jesuses in their stained glass windows, on their Sunday school walls, or we can go to boarding schools for Native Americans where there was this kind of cognitive dissonance moment where young Native American boys would be having their hair cut short. So their long hair would be cut short at these kind of missionary schools as part of a way to civilize them. And they'd be looking at the wall at supposedly the most civilized man ever, Jesus, who was white and had long hair. And so, but then these Native American churches and Native American schools would also have white Jesus imagery. And so the reality of how we depict a God, it has a lot more to do with who has the ability to create images and who has the power to disseminate them. And at that point, money, time, productive capabilities become far more important than some of these other things, just like just what I happen to look like.
My guest is Edward Bloom. He's a professor of history at San Diego State University and co-author of the book The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America. We're going to be talking about Black Nativity 2012 coming up this weekend in Columbus later on in the show. If you have a question or comment for Edward Bloom now, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what do we know for a fact about the race or the looks of Jesus at all? Anything much?
You know, no, not really. And this is what's so fascinating about the Christian Bible is we get four, quote-unquote, biographies, right? Four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all writing, you know, where did Jesus go? Where did he walk? What did he say? It talks about bodies. They talk about bleeding bodies. They talk about broken bodies. But when it comes to things like hair length or skin pigmentation or eye color, nothing. Not one single word in those accounts. And so what's so interesting to me is why today are we so thoughtful, so mindful, so obsessed about it when these different writers then had basically no interest in what Jesus looked like, at least for what they chose to put to paper.
Yeah, I mean, writing in terms of their contemporaries of the day, writers, people who are writing anything, and I guess probably a lot of it was religious, but are descriptions of people very common anyway?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What's more likely to be described then is clothing.
Hmm.
And so, for instance, you know, in the Bible, we know John the Baptist. We get a pretty vivid description of him. But in what he wears, because he wears, you know, different clothes than those than others, and then there's descriptions of like kind of what people eat, and it's not because there's usually then this assumption that oh, it's because everyone looked the same. In fact, the Middle East, you know, where Jesus was 2,000 years ago, that was the crossroads of the known world. There were people from all over the place interacting there. You know, we even get the kings who come, you know, who to the Nativity, and there's no description of what they look like. There's a description of what they bring, you know. And so ancient writers tended to spend a lot more time writing about the natural environment, or writing about what, you know, what material objects looked like, not so much about the human form. That really becomes that's a much more modern emphasis to really struggle and think about the particularities of the human body.
American iconic imagery of Jesus came about in about the early 1800s, which is much later than I expected. Was something similar happening in other parts of the world?
Yeah, so there's this moment right before, like basically about 100 years before the American Revolution, where we have the Protestant Reformation and we have this kind of iconoclasm. We see all these Protestant Christians reject Catholic icons, right? And they literally, you know, they destroy them throughout Europe. Puritans in New England will scratch out crosses, not even crucifixes, just literally a cross. They'll tear them out of their book pages. And then we get to the 19th century, and what we see in Europe, in Western Europe, what we see in the United States, even what we see in China, in fact, is the creation of images and images of Jesus. And part of this is because of a paper revolution. We see a revolution in technology where basically it becomes much cheaper and much easier to produce imagery on paper. And we can even think about this. If you or I were to go into a library and try to get letters from people in, you know, 1700 writing letters, a lot of those people would write on the page, you know, up, down, and then they would turn the page on its side and literally write over top of what they'd already written. And that's because paper was such a prized commodity. Well, once you can print more cheaply, you can get paper more printly, then you see these kind of Protestant Christians start producing images. But there's a problem. The problem is they know their grandparents wouldn't like it. So they have to justify why they're presenting sacred imagery.
And how do they do that?
Oh, and why?
Yeah.
And the answer they would give is always the children. They always give the answer, you know, we need to reach out to children. Because if a religious group, think about this, if a religious tradition gets no children involved, gets another generation, if there are no more Catholics, mm-hmm. you know, after today, no one ever becomes Catholic again, that tradition dies in one generation. And so the argument is we need to get children invested in our faith, in Protestant Christianity. And in the United States, that's really important in the early 19th century because we want to continue the nation. It's a new country. The United States people are fearful of being gobbled up by other European powers. And so, okay, we've got to Christianize our children. And children are more susceptible to imagery than they are to text. And so they can learn to think of Jesus as their friend by seeing depictions of him before they can read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. And so that's the argument is always we've got to reach out to our children. And we need to use, quote-unquote, entertaining portrayals.
You know, it's interesting. When I think about it, probably one of the first images I have in my mind of Jesus is always he's sitting on, like, a rock or something, and he's surrounded by children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that image, it becomes really kind of very particularly famous around the turn of the 20th century, around 1900, which is also the time of where childhood is developed as a kind of separate entity. Because if we go back to 1800, most people are farmers, right? Mm-hmm. And so by the time you're seven, there's no childhood for you. You go out and you work in the field. By 1900, we see children doing things like going to school. We see labor laws that don't allow you to, you know, put your kid in a coal mine. And so now we have this distinct time period called childhood, right? And so then we get all these images of, we even get Jesus loves all the children of the world. That song comes out after the American Civil War. And the images, right, you get, and you usually get children from all over the world or children looking quite different, all kind of seated below Jesus. And that's to make him, you know, this, you know, older brother, friend, mentor figure. And yeah, those images just take off.
You say that after the American Revolution, the white Jesus was first used to try and bring unity and purpose to a young nation. And it sounded like when I was reading that, that there were modern day marketers at work. And I was wondering, were they doing this consciously as a unifying theme?
Yeah, so in one, they're not doing it consciously. There's no one sitting, you know, and writing from a boardroom, we're going to justify slavery and we're going to, you know, link, unite all the kind of white Americans together around this Jesus image. It's more subtle than that. It's a moral problem. Okay, Americans know there's nothing biblical about shoving Native Americans off of the land. Okay, and partly they know this because there are white missionaries with Cherokee Indians saying, hey, there's nothing moral about, you know, violently taking land from these people. And we see also at that time, around 1820, an increasing number of white Americans saying, you know what, enslavement might be in the Bible, but the particular brand of slavery in America doesn't seem very Christian. When masters have the right to rape, you know, to have sex with their slaves, right? They're not married to their slave. How is this biblical? How is this Christian? So we see this kind of a rise of, these are immoralities or perceived immoralities. And all of a sudden, a number of white Americans start depicting Jesus as white in those venues. So President Andrew Jackson, who leads in many ways the Cherokee removal, he actually says the most Christian thing, this is the language he used, the most Christian thing we can do is remove the Cherokee. Now, and then how is he justifying that? The way it gets justified is this: the creation of the white Jesus justifies it this way. The natural created hierarchy of races is with white people on top. It's so much so that when God even made himself, he made himself white. And therefore, when we say it's best for you to be enslaved, when we say it's best for you to be moved, we're not just, that's not just hypocritical. We really now believe it because we can speak for what's best, just as Jesus spoke for what's best. So what they do by creating Jesus as white is you take the onus off the words Jesus said, okay, like to mourn with those who mourn, and you put the onus on what he supposedly looked like. And it was part of interacting with slaves, for instance. Masters, Southern masters, made a big deal about calling themselves that word, master. And then they would present images of Jesus as, quote, master, and present him as white. And that was all very conscious of, we want to teach slaves from a very young age that basically we are akin to the Almighty. And there's a real quick last story. There's this great guy named Henry Brown. Henry Brown was a slave from Virginia. He literally boxed himself to freedom, meaning he put himself in a box and he mailed himself. He had a friend mail him through from Richmond, Virginia, to Pennsylvania. He wrote that when he was, so in freedom, he wrote a memoir, and he said when he was 7 years old, he literally believed his master was God Almighty and his master's son was Jesus Christ, and that he didn't figure that out until he was 8 years old that wasn't the truth. I mean, this is how powerful that kind of imagery, the impact it has on people.
My guest is Edward Bloom, professor of history at San Diego State University. He's also the co-author of a new book. It's called The Color of Christ, The Son of God, and the Saga of Race in America. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The cover of the New York Post shows a man on the tracks moments before an oncoming train ends his life. Now the photographer and the editors who ran the image are at the center of a controversy over media and morals. I'm Ari Shapiro, photojournalism and ethics, plus Senator Sheldon Whitehouse on the fiscal cliff. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And Sunday night, join the Ohio State University School of Music for a showcase of its many performing groups, from the OSU Symphony Orchestra to its jazz ensemble, glee clubs, and symphonic band. It's the OSU Holiday Extravaganza, Sunday night at 8 on WOSU TV. And support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center, announcing the opening of the Spirit of Women Park thanks to the generous support of the Ingram family. Located near the Wexner Medical Center, the Spirit of Women Park features thousands of tiles hand-painted by donors to honor special women in their lives. medicalcenter.osu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Edward Bloom. He's a professor of history at San Diego State University and also the co-author of the book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America. We are going to be talking about Black Nativity 2012 coming up later on in the program. The annual production is set to be staged this weekend. If you have any questions or comments about that, you can check our website out at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you or a phone number. Edward Bloom, the most reproduced image in world history, and I had to read that back three or four times to make sure I was getting it straight, is one of Jesus, a white Jesus depicted by the artist Warner Salmon. Who was he, and why did he create the image? And I guess, why is it such an important image?
Yeah, so Warner Salmon's Head of Christ from 1941 is just iconic. It's everywhere. It's even in, if you've seen the movie The Help, the main character, she has a portrait of her dead son, and above it is the Warner Salmon Head of Christ. So Warner Salmon was the son of Northern European immigrants, basically Swedish immigrants, to the Midwest. And he was a fundamentalist Christian and an artist, and he's kind of circulated around Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. And a dean there, this was in the 1930s, had said, you know, all the images we have of Jesus are so feminine. You know, we always think of him as, you know, just being with children, kind of coming out of that school of thought, you know, Jesus with all the little children. Mm-hmm. And let's have a kind of more manly Jesus for a more manly age. And so Warner Salmon set to it. And what he produced to us actually probably looks more feminine than masculine, but it's basically a profile headshot of Jesus. There's nothing in the background. It's just him with long blondish brown hair, blue eyes. Jesus isn't looking at us. He's looking kind of into the distance. And this takes off partly because it's at exactly the right moment. World War II is happening. The United States is about to enter the war, and a group of marketers in the Midwest kind of jump on this moment. They create basically baseball card size, wallet sized images of this, and they give them to GIs who are heading over to Europe, to Asia. At the same time, 4 years later, or a couple years later, Billy Graham's revivals will emerge, and Graham will use the Warner Salmon Head of Christ, big, huge billboard backdrops. And so the Warner Salmon Head of Christ, it's perfectly situated at this moment when America is going to rise, you know, because the rest of the world is in ashes. It's perfectly situated because we're going to have a revival that's an evangelical revival that's kind of where people are concerned about the end of the world, you know, now with the nuclear apocalypse is possible. And the image itself is really soothing in a lot of ways. And this is also part of you know, in the 1950s, we see the emergence of the kind of Leave It to Beaver America, mm-hmm. this kind of imagined America where everyone lives in the suburbs and things are calm and you just have your kind of, you know, silly little fun problems. So this Jesus, how does he connect to that? Well, he doesn't look at us. So he's never peering into our souls. This Jesus listens to us. It's his ear that's actually focused toward us. And there was a Chicago pastor at the time who had a very upset middle-class wife come to him. And she said, my husband never listens to me. He comes home from work. He's tired. He sits down. He just wants to watch TV. The pastor takes in one of the Warner Salmon Heads of Christ and hands it to her and says, see his ear, speaking of Jesus. It's always pointed toward you. He's always listening. In that story, right, it's the notion that Jesus is a friend who listens, and he's a surrogate husband in that case. So he's not judgmental. He listens. Since there's no backdrop, there's no palm trees, right? There's no donkeys in the background. So if you're in Minnesota, there's no distance. You know, you're saying, oh, okay, you know, this could be where I am. And so it's the right time, the right place. He's also very white, blue-eyed, and that just appeals to people, and it just takes off in the 40s. And one last wrinkle to this.
Uh-huh.
The 50s is also the moment of an emerging, quote, tri-faith America, where Protestants and Catholics, who'd struggled for so long, who'd fought so long in America against each other, are starting to kind of unite. And when a Protestant creates an image of Jesus, Catholics can also kind of can run to that as well. And so Catholic churches use Solomon's Head of Christ as the two. So they can agree upon, they may not agree upon the Pope, they may not agree upon issues of contraception, but they can agree upon, yeah, we like this image of Jesus.
But, you know, not everybody liked it. I was surprised to read that there were some people who were outspoken critics of this trend toward the white Jesus, and that they tried to address what reality was and wasn't.
Yeah, there were. And we can go all the way back in time to 1830, to the first American to challenge the white Jesus. And that was actually a Pequot Methodist. But if we fast forward into the 20th century, we get folks from, you know, Marcus Garvey and his Back to Africa campaign saying he would tell his followers never admit that Jesus was white. We get Malcolm X saying, you know, that Jesus was brown and that if you believe he was white, you're just another brainwashed individual. And then we get some other kind of lesser-known moments. Vernon Jordan, who was Bill Clinton's attorney friend, when he was in college, he went to a principally white college. Well, he performed as Jesus during essentially like a passion play. And some of the people there kind of freaked out. They had this moment of, oh, it's blasphemy to depict Jesus as black. Well, and that led Vernon Jordan as a college student to say, you know, no, why do you think he's white? So we get very famous. We get very kind of people who are outspoken leaders at the time, like a Marcus Garvey or a Malcolm X. And then we get, you know, more, you know, kind of 19-year-old kid saying, hey, wait, no, why do you assume Jesus was white? In fact, Martin Luther King Jr. had a letter sent to him asking, basically, if God made most people non-white, why did he make Jesus white? This is the letter writer. This is an African-American letter writer to mm-hmm. King. King writes back. King responds to the letter saying, you know what? The color of Christ doesn't matter. His skin doesn't matter. It's the content of his character. Then King says, Jesus would not have been less important if he were black. He is not more important because he was white. This is King. Mm-hmm. King saying, no, Jesus was white. A respondent, a letter writer, responds to King and says, whoa, whoa, whoa. What makes you think Jesus was white? King never responds because he didn't have an answer. He didn't mm-hmm. have an explanation. But the point of it is there are people on the ground who know. They've read their Bibles. They know their kind of world history. They're not famous. They're not well known. But they know this white Jesus is a man-made image and not necessarily, you know, reflecting what Jesus actually looked like.
William in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, William.
Yes. Is there not a reference to Jesus as having woolly hair in the Bible? Is that true?
Edward?
Yeah, so in the book of, there's two places in the Bible that people turn to for physical descriptions of Jesus. One is the book of Revelations, which...
Book of Revelations.
Yeah, so that's Willie?
William.
Oh, William. I'm sorry, William. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the book of Revelations, John, the Apostle John, is describing this vision he has of when Jesus returns. And it's really complicated, and it mixes a whole lot of different imagery together. But in that case, his eyes are on fire, and his hair is described as woolly in this return. And so a number of readers have taken that to mean he must have been a person of color. He must have been, in some way African. So that is one interpretation people take of the very complicated book of Revelation.
Thank you, William.
Thank you.
Yep. An email from Gio. It says, as I understand it, the white image of Christ is derived from the image of Caesar Borgieri from the 1500s. I think I might have massacred that name. They go on to say, my question is a simple hope that your guest can shed some light, some type of light on this, either to the positive or to the negative. Any thoughts, Edward Bloom?
Yeah, so there is not, I'm not familiar with that, what you just referenced, but there is a hoax from the 15th century called the Publius Lentulus letter. So this is kind of Da Vinci Code stuff, where a monk in the 15th century fabricated a letter where a Roman consulate describes what Jesus looked like. And it talks about his hair being parted in the middle, long to the shoulders, having a beard parted in the middle. And it was created... The letter was fabricated to basically justify European artwork, and it was as Europeans were starting to interact with Asians, to interact more, start to move toward the top kind of Western Africa. And here's the funny thing about the Publius Lentulus letter: everyone knows it's a fake. Everyone knows it's a fraud, and even American writers talk about it. They talk about, they read it and they laugh at it, or they say, yeah, it's a fake, we know this isn't biblical. But then in the 19th century, a number of Americans start saying, white Americans, we know it's not true, but isn't it a nice description? And then in the 20th century, it's described as an actual description of Jesus. So it's a case where a hoax is known as a fraud, and it becomes a hoped-for reality. But that's the Publius Lentulus letter. I'm not sure of what the emailer is actually describing.
Oh. Omar and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have a comment about the image of Jesus around the world. I really thought that, historically speaking, that the creation of the image of Jesus, although there's no description in the Bible, wasn't it the attempt to create an image has to do with how relevant the image should have been to the culture to be acceptable? An example, the image of Jesus, before the Renaissance and during the Renaissance, the image of Jesus that's blonde with blue eyes, could you imagine the Europeans really would have somebody who would look, an outsider, not European, obviously, isn't going to be accepted. And the Christian wanted, acceptance. I came from the Middle East, and, Jesus, neither black nor white. He really looks Semite. I've seen Chinese Jesus. I've seen Japanese-looking Jesus. Am I wrong?
Edward?
No, you're definitely not wrong. These images... Various cultures creating images of Jesus kind of in their own likeness, those definitely exist. Partly today we know of them because we live in a digital age. So if we're to Google image search, Semite Jesus, Jewish Jesus, Korean Jesus, African Jesus, we can locate them. But if we go back in time, there's a time, you know, 100 years ago, you're not going to find, if you're white, black, or Native American, you're not going to find imagery of Jesus as African very easily. You know, I think we can all remember this in our own lifetimes. Go back to when we were children doing research papers at school and how difficult it was to get access to information, right, and to get access to imagery. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, today we can locate, yes, oh, here's a Chinese Jesus. But if we go back into, you know, 1900, when there are European missionaries and American missionaries trying to really get into China, the imagery they're bringing with them, the imagery in their books, their Sunday school literature, it's not of a Chinese-looking Jesus. It's of this white Jesus. Here's the other trick to this. The point to depicting Jesus is never to make him fully look like our culture, because the point is he's both God and man, right? So we want him to look like us, maybe, but also somehow distinct. And so even like the Werner Salmon Head of Christ, that really famous one, that doesn't look like anybody in 1941. There aren't professional-looking white men with long hair like that. It's the long hair might speak to a different time, a different age, because it's both Jesus with us and Jesus outside of us that kind of is important to the story. But, I mean, Omar is right that these images do exist. It's but that's more a function of we can find them today, we can locate them, versus 100 years ago, people really couldn't.
So they weren't, people didn't see them. Omar, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're almost out of time, Edward Bloom, but I wanted to ask you a question about something you wrote about popular culture in the 60s and 70s, actually, when discussion in television sitcoms started to once in a while revolve around religion, which was unusual, and then what Jesus looked like. And you reminded me of Good Times. I don't particularly remember the episode that you mentioned, but I almost think I can remember it now because I remember the show so well. But JJ, the teenage artist in the family, used a local black drunk and a prophet as his inspiration for a portrait of Jesus. And the joke was it was because that was the guy that would sit still long enough for him to do draw the picture. But the really interesting conversation occurred when the family had to decide whether the white Jesus would remain on their wall. And you talked about Martin Luther King and his response or lack thereof to the issue of what Jesus looked like. What do we know about the conversations that were occurring back then?
Yeah, so in the 60s and the 70s, that Good Times episode is so fascinating because, you know, JJ, it's hard for him to make a painting. It costs money, it takes time, right, to even imagine Jesus as black, to actually put it to paper. Mm-hmm. These were conversations happening on the ground all over the place. This one pastor in Detroit, Albert Klieg, would talk about how he went to seminary. He's a black man, goes to a white seminary, and he comes home and he's talking to his mother, and he mentions something about Jesus being white. And his mother says, no, Jesus was white. Jesus was black. Your professor's wrong. And so on the ground level, even in the 50s and the 60s, we see everyday people rejecting the icons presented to them, even the icons in their churches. You know, even the vast majority of black churches at those times would have white stained glass images of Jesus. And then in the 70s, something new happens. Humor. We get, not that humor's created then, but we get the first jokes that start to revolve around the body of Jesus. And then as we move forward from the 70s, they're now everywhere. I mean, you and I, we turn on South Park, we turn on Family Guy, we watch movies.
Exactly.
Jokes about Jesus are everywhere, Jesus about his body. And to me, what's fascinating about that is before the 60s, right, we're a country that kills over bodies, the Civil War. We're a country that fights legally and culturally over bodies, the Civil Rights Movement. Why then do we joke about these issues, you know, post-1970? Maybe it's because we laugh because it's a way to resolve the tension. You know, I was listening to your previous interview about we laugh because there's that moment of tension. Ooh, we're bringing up race and Jesus, tense. then we resolve it through, ha, 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 look at how white he is, or he's black, ooh, that shock humor. And so it's part of this, we've grown so much as a country, but we have so many tensions still unresolved, that that's the way we kind of deal with that tension today is to laugh it out rather than shoot it out or legislate it out.
Well, Edward Blum, thanks for talking it out today with me.
Great. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed this.
Edward Blum, he's a professor of history at San Diego State University. We've been talking about his new book that he co-wrote with Paul Harvey. It's called The Color of Christ, the Son of God, and the Saga of Race in America. When we return, we're going to talk about Black Nativity 2012. The show starts in Columbus this weekend. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Judd Apatow has directed films about people who have trouble growing up, like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. But he takes on adulthood, marriage, and parenthood in his new film, This Is 40, starring his wife, Leslie Mann, and Paul Rudd. We'll talk about the characters' lives and Apatow's own life on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a look at Vatican II, 50 years later, and the state of the Roman Catholic Church today. And then All Sides Weekend with host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. That's All Sides on Friday from 10 until noon. 37 degrees in downtown Columbus with some sunshine, a high near 48 today. And rain overnight and rain for Friday as well, a high of 55 on Friday. Support for 89.7 comes from Mauburn Academy, a leader in college preparatory education for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting a community parent seminar, How to Get High School to Work for ADHD Students and How to Get ADHD Students to Work in High School. December 11th at 7 p.m., mauburnacademy.org. And support comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing non-medical home health care and companionship to seniors in Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
That's from Black Nativity 2012. The Black Nativity is by author and playwright Langston Hughes. It was first performed off Broadway in 1961. Since then, it has been produced around the country, including in Columbus for the last, this will be the 13th year, I think. Neo Performing Arts Theater Company presents Black Nativity 2012 this weekend at the King Arts Complex. For more information, you can call 614-645-5464. We'll also post that phone number on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now to talk about the show and the 2012 production in particular is Black Nativity 2012 director Ron Hairston. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Way, thank you for allowing us to be here. I'm excited to be here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Also with us is cast member Rita Arnold. Welcome to the show, Rita.
Thank you so much for having us.
This year's theme is It's Just Jesus.
Yes.
And before we get to the idea behind that,
sure.
I wanted to talk about the idea that there is a new theme every year, a new twist of the show every year, that Nativity 2012 is different than all the others that have gone before in Columbus, and maybe different from ones in other cities.
Absolutely.
Okay, so why the change up every year?
Well, the main reason is we want to give the community a new look, a fresh look each year, and we do present, you know, the basic theme of that Langston Hughes originally presented in his original work. But we want to give the community a different look, a different aspect, a different perspective of the Nativity each year.
Do they do that in other cities as well?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I have a cousin who lives in Boston, and their presentation, he did let me know that their presentation year after year is practically the same. Yeah, but ours, we want to give a fresh look, different music, especially in the second act.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, different music and everything.
Yeah,
I mean, what is your sense about what Langston Hughes intended for it? Do you feel like it's in the spirit of what he intended?
Absolutely. I believe at Langston, when the play was originally presented, the artists that were involved were particularly the gospel artists that were featured Professor Alex Bradford. He was what one might term the prince of gospel music of that particular era. And also he had the dynamic voice of Marion Williams, who was a member of the Clara Ward Singers, a mm-hmm. powerful, powerful soprano. I mean, she could would tear up a church, as we would say. Awesome voice. And also the music of that time, the various rhythms in African-American music at that time, that was what was featured. And so we tried to update it, so
okay.
to speak, with what's current and what's exciting today.
Rita Arnold, tell
yes.
us about the role you play and how it fits into the overall story.
In previous years, I've played the innkeeper's wife. This year, I'm not the innkeeper's wife, but we have a way of each having our own role on the stage and bringing to life some part of, in the first act, the African village. Mm-hmm. And in the second act, that character in church, and not that character, but that person that we all know who sits on the pew with us from Sunday to Sunday, worshiping with us. And we all take a little bit of that piece with us onto the stage.
I was in a press, I guess it was in the press release that I received, Ron, you were quoted saying that even when we go through difficult times, as some of our individual cast members are experiencing,
yeah.
we should keep it in our hearts and that it's all about him receiving honor and glory for our lives. And I was wondering, do you incorporate somehow or direct using real life experiences in the production?
Mm. It's funny that you would
ask
that.
Was that a good question?
Yes, that's a good question, yes. Absolutely, especially this year.
Yes.
You mentioned things that we do differently. Well,
uh-huh.
There's just in the second act, I've incorporated, since our theme is just Jesus, since that is our theme, I asked the entire cast member, entire cast, to, if they could, in five words or less, if they could write down something that they have experienced that they know that the Lord, that God had to, it had to be God that
Absolutely.
Brought them through and mm-hmm. helped them through the situation, five words or less. And in order to introduce the song, the theme song of the show, Just Jesus, if they could write in five words or less, a little testimony. And in the show, they're going to do those, what we call popcorn praises, testimonies, right in the midst of the show. So,
did they
yeah.
know that when that
yes.
they were going to be doing that
yes.
when you asked them to do
no,
it?
No, they didn't.
Okay, I was
going to
say, because sometimes
initially.
That can color what they'll
no,
say.
No, just said, let me have five words or less. And each one wrote, some wrote it down, you know, and we're going to incorporate those in the show.
I think what you find when you hear those praises is that someone in the audience is inevitably going to identify
yes.
fully with what each person says, and none of them are the same.
Right,
and
right.
it's a beautiful communal experience.
Absolutely.
On the stage and from the audience perspective.
Now, I've just watched it on YouTube, and it looks like so much fun and so fantastic.
Absolutely.
By the way, I watched not last year's, but I think 2009
uh-huh.
and 2008. Anyway, it's very participatory.
Right.
Yes,
you
right.
want the audience to participate.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yes.
What are some of the things you do to draw them in, besides the fabulous music, but they wouldn't necessarily know the words unless you kind of teach them there on the fly?
No, we don't. No, no, no.
Okay.
Some people come to the production knowing some of the songs.
Sure.
But it's
I think it's more the atmosphere.
Yeah.
The atmosphere
yeah.
that we create yeah. on that stage makes it so that it's difficult for you to sit still in your seat. You want to be a part of
Absolutely.
The praise and worship that we're doing. And the singing that we're doing is so exuberant. And we bring such energy to everything that's happening
them.
On that stage. That's right. Or our director will be so upset if we're not energetic. We bring such energy to it that you want to feel a part of that, too. And I talk to people. We have a tradition of lining up to meet our guests mm-hmm. after each performance. And people come through and they say how energized they feel and mm-hmm. how thankful they are that they came. They were so tired beforehand. It's been a long week. But after this performance, they just feel such energy and such joy, and they love it.
You know, sometimes after a long day, it's hard to go out and then go to a performance or something to prepare for the show. But my producer did last night, and he said it was very... It was a lot of fun. It was very energizing and exciting. So that the show is airing, or not airing, the production is at the King Arts Complex this weekend. For more information, you can go to our website. We have a phone number posted there that you can
awesome.
Call for more information. My guests right now, Ron Hairston, he's director of Black Nativity 2012, and also Rita Arnold. She's a cast member of Black Nativity 2012. If you have a question or comment for them, we've got a few minutes, so take the time. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. There are 40 or so roles.
40 or so cast members.
Cast members, okay.
Ranging mostly everybody is singing. We have several dancers, and everybody is involved. Those that are singing are involved in acting in some point.
And how big of a deal is it to get to participate as part of the cast, Rita?
It's really cool.
Are there really auditions? Is. Do people get in line to get into the show?
I have to tell you, this year my personal schedule changed, and I didn't think I was going to be able to participate, and I was really bummed about it. And then I started getting phone calls from my family and friends who know I participate every year, and they were like, excuse me, what? So I started moving some things around, and I made a way to be a part of this, and I'm so happy that I did. It becomes a part of your family, your yearly cycle.
So it's great for people who go to it and see it and are moved by it and energized by it, but there's also, for you, for everyone in the cast, every time you show up to
Absolutely.
Rehearse, there must be that same sort of feeling, yeah. right?
It's a regenerating spirit
yeah.
that gets in us. And, you know, life is rough sometimes, and you have hard days, and there's sickness,
yeah.
and everybody's
yeah.
got money troubles
yeah.
these days. But when we get together, we pray together, and we fellowship together. And honestly, it's like family. And, you know, cousins that you haven't seen for a while, when we get back together after the summer and rehearsals start again, we're so excited to see each other.
Let me just say, this girl
sure.
can sing. This girl, she's hitting some notes.
Really?
I didn't know was in her.
It's the NEA Performing Arts Theater Company.
Yes.
I've been getting press releases for a few years now about this, and I'm wondering, what is the NEA Performing Arts Theater Company?
Well, NEA Performing Arts, the name NEA comes from one of the seven principles of Kwanzaa. NEA means purpose. And our purpose is to bring the theatrical arts to our community, to be a part of the theatrical arts community in Columbus, Ohio. We have, this past year, one of the reasons that Black Nativity we were in such a crunch this year was because we did a production entitled It's Hell Getting Old. And
I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you had to be there to see.
Yeah, there you go.
That's another story.
Okay.
But anyway, we as soon as that was over, we started right into Black Nativity rehearsal. And it's been a really crunch time for us.
How long have you been rehearsing?
Well, we've been rehearsing since the end of September.
Yeah.
Since the end of September. But usually we start rehearsing
in August,
the end of August, and because of some conflicts with the King Arts Complex, we usually present it mid December, but now it's early December, and we were really, really, really crunched this year for time. But we all pulled together, and it's going to happen.
Oh yes, it is.
It's going to happen.
Let's get back to the question of the theme of the show this year. Mm-hmm. It's
just Jesus.
It's just Jesus, which seems sort of kind of no duh. You know, you always hear that Jesus is the reason for the season and all that kind of stuff. So I don't mean to be disrespectful.
Right. Not
of
at all.
But how did that emerge for you as a theme to break out this year?
Well, every year the board, since I've been directing, and this is my sixth year.
Wow.
Yeah, my sixth year. And I had Jalen was the one to remind me. Yes. Jalen is another one of the young people who have grown up.
Powerhouse singer.
Yeah, she's another powerhouse singer. But Jalen started when she was 13 with Black Nativity, and now she is going on to college. So anyway, Jalen reminded me that this would be my sixth year involved as the director of Black Nativity. And the theme came to me at the end of last year's production. And that's kind of how things happen with me as far as developing the theme. Because of the idea, I believe what happened was that the idea came to me because of Christmas, this time, has gotten to be awfully commercialized.
Yes.
And our focus has been taken away from the real meaning, the real essence of it. The gifts and toys are fine, but it's about the babe who grew up to be a man who took away our sins. And that's what we're celebrating.
Absolutely.
The King of Kings and the Lord of Lords and the Prince of Peace.
I have to say, every year we have a different theme, and sometimes we see the music list and we're listening to the songs, and I kind of think, and I'm like, okay, I trust my director, but I'm not sure where he's going with this. But honestly, once we get our musician, who our director of music is a phenomenal, phenomenal musician.
Who is that?
Pastor Timothy Carpenter.
Yes.
Okay.
He is wonderful.
Awesome.
And he has taken the traditional music of the first half, mm-hmm. and absolutely infused the flavor of Africa into it.
Yes.
And then he's taken the songs that we've chosen for the second half and songs that honestly I didn't like. I have grown to love. I promise you, I listened to a couple of those songs. I've heard them on the radio. You know,
it's all
they've
how
been
they're
sung.
Dished up then.
Well, yeah. He's taken the songs and once our voices wrap around them. And this year, make no mistake, these voices are strong.
Ooh.
And they are doing work.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful thing to hear. But he's made these songs so wonderful and so beautiful.
Well, looking forward to hearing it.
All right.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Rita Arnold. She's a cast member of Black Nativity 2012. Thanks for joining us, Rita.
Thank you.
Also with us, Ron Hairston. He's director of Black Nativity 2012. Thanks for joining us, Ron.
Thank you for having us.
Once again, you can call 614-645-5464. We'll post that number on our website as well at wosu.org/allsides. We're going to listen as we leave the show today to some more music. Thanks for listening. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.